Okay, this is part four of the May 15th session. He takes these media, McLuhan takes these media in the understanding media and makes them static models of our time. For example, he says that the television is an extension or model of the central nervous system. So they're models of our chemical body knowledge.
Yeah.
All right, so he says they can be in book form, static, imagistic models. They can be symbols in the literate sense.
Mm-hmm.
But do these myths or these collective skills and experience that constitute both spoken languages and such new languages as movies or radio, but do they not tend, like languages in general, to be dynamic models of the universe in action?
Mm-hmm.
Which is another aspect of preliterate myth. It was used, they used to, you know, like the American Native Indians, they create a story to bring the rain. They dance out the myth, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
So multi-sensory preliterate uses of communication, which we categorize as myth, they can be dynamic models of the universe in action rather than just static models. So he's showing the multi-sensory, non-visual use of languages and newer media as participatory interactions.
Mm-hmm.
He says, as such, languages only would be for participation rather than for contemplation or for reference and classification. Look at that, contemplation. Generally standing back and looking at it, or reference and classification, that's what print did.
Mm-hmm.
So he's saying such languages, old, new, would seem to be for participation rather than for visual space bias. Now, participation means that if you look at, he's leading up to pointing out that television, it has a bunch of news today and a bunch of stories today, and then there's more news and more stories and goes on and on and on, never stops. And if you think you're waiting for a particular message, you'll suffer a sense of information overload because you never get to the point.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to drive you mad like Chinese water torture. But when you understand that it's not the content of TV that is the main function of it, that is participatory thing where you turn on just to experience the space and have a phatic relationship to it, and another meaning of phatic is participation, mystique, this is the function of preliterate myths and environments or languages or macromyths, and is what the new languages or macromyths are for.
Mm-hmm.
So he found a way to show a meaning for myth that is not limited to classification and usually a naming of true or false, largely false, in relation to scientific information, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's classified as primitive forms of hallucination. That's what the visual person does. No, it's not just a visual phenomenon. It's not just a story. It's a means and mode of participation, collective participation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, before he develops the idea that new media are mythic or macromyths, he said he wants to say that new media are new languages.
Yeah, right.
Now, here's where I think that might be metaphoric. I'm looking up the word linguistics, and it says...
What do you mean by saying it could be metaphoric? From McLuhan's point of view, everything is a translation. Everything is a metaphor. And their active process is not the idea that Western people have of metaphor as a static symbol or model.
Yeah. But he's
like
still...
the yin-yang sign.
He's still...
a metaphor in the literate sense.
He's using English, and he's got to match with English words. Or, you know, he could be writing anything he wants to, and it would only mean something to him. Now, he's actually, I think he's taking some English words here and sculpting or reshaping them to suit his purposes, and then explaining what he means by that. So he brings you along.
Yeah.
But if you don't understand his use of the language, which is not common, you can't follow him.
Right. That's because he has a new view. And so it's always, as he said, communication of the new is a miracle, but not impossible.
Yeah.
To get across something new takes work to express and to interpret. The reader, the consumer of it, has to do some work.
Yeah.
And it usually fails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he's communicating something new, but you got to take a few steps to climb into his head, and he gives you the tools to do that.
Yeah, and... when I said you, it's hard to communicate, it's hard to match with exactly what he meant. But if you don't match with it, then you take McLuhan and use it for your own purposes, which he may not agree with, but you think you're you got new ideas from just reading him. You may not get what he meant.
Right.
And then that's why people say that many people made millions of dollars off of McLuhan, generally in the content media world.
Yeah. They saw something new that they could apply to their discipline.
Yeah. It made them have a just slightly different, more detached, imaginative view to what they could do.
Mm-hmm.
They realized that they didn't need the book and its values as a model.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I remember Jack Nicholson years ago in an interview said, when he read McLuhan on Cliché, maybe it was the book Cliché Archetype, but he read somewhere McLuhan on Cliché, he said that was the greatest insight for him.
Mm-hmm.
He had, whatever he thought Cliché was, he realized Cliché was something else.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what he got from McLuhan.
Right.
So, now you're going to go back and say he's being metaphorical here?
Well, that he's fudging with the word by calling new media language, because language, like I say, it kind of comes from linguistics, and linguistics...
Verbal media.
Verbal media, yeah.
That's illiterate.
Well, that's what we... Language, linguistics, verbal media, they're all related, but he's taking language out of...
The mouth.
The mouth, yeah.
And he's telling you, and he's proving it. He's saying, let's look at language as a collection of experience,
mm-hmm.
representing a collective, inclusive collective awareness.
Yeah, and that is the purpose of language, yeah.
Right, and so couldn't we say movies and TV? Now, he's speaking in the 50s when people think media, new media, just entertainment.
They, mm-hmm.
They're totally 19th century in relation to this, right? They're totally mm-hmm. logocentric. So he's step-by-step leading them along with baby steps, saying, well, if that's language is a collective experience, don't you think movies and television are a collective experience?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And then they go, yeah. It's, well, okay, they're like languages. Well, okay, language, new media. So they break through that logocentric bias, right?
Yeah.
And then he develops it in relation to the word myth. And then he wants to realize, since most people read about myth in books, like Joseph Campbell, categorizing and defining the different religions and myths, he says, well, there's something more participatory in myth. It's not just, it wasn't a story for the people who lived the myth.
Mm-hmm.
They multi-sensory participation with it.
Mm-hmm.
And that explains Finnegan's Wake.
Mm-hmm.
Finnegan's Wake is something that you participate with. He made it obscure so that you have to get involved.
Yeah.
You begin to dance with it.
Yeah, yep. And read it aloud. It's meant to be read aloud.
And so you're not reading it for a linear, classifiable story. Oh, the story had a sad ending, or it had a bad, happy ending. You know what I mean? That's a classification.
Yeah.
And he told me through the evergreens that he made the book difficult so that it would be reread.
Yeah. And I remember Jerry or somebody telling me a story that they heard about somebody that was reading Finnegan's Wake to their little child.
Yeah.
And the kid loved it because... The words were so multisensual they could project their own worlds into what was being read to them without having to match with some literate artist.
Yeah, they were probably being tickled to death by it.
Yeah,
I was tickled verbally.
Yeah,
and it was not limited to the canon.
Yeah.
Hear the voice with repeated or reflected concepts.
Yeah.
So you see how I carefully laid out the page.
Yeah.
This is a mini course in McLuhan in the way and order of quotes that I very carefully selected.
Yeah.
As you'll see through this section, just like I did with LaRouche and the others. Yeah. We began with spoken word, and we're still working on spoken word.
Right.
We're now dealing with myth and macro myth.
Yeah. You know, it just occurred to me how groundbreaking Finnegan's Wake is within the context of what I'm thinking about. I think it was Piaget I was reading years ago, and he was talking about how when you play sounds, when the infant is in the womb, you can play make certain sounds like phonemes or something, where when the fetus hears it or receives it in whatever way it does, some part of its nervous system will kick as a reaction to that sound. You know, he was just building up a case that language starts in the womb before the child's, while the nervous system is forming, the elements of the phonemes of language are coalescing, coming together, and becoming ready to absorb the local language and to begin to speak. And Joyce was, I mean, so language is so native, it's so central to our, you know, the formation of the nervous system, and here Joyce is like breaking it all apart, reforming it and playing with it like music, which is like, you know, I mean, it's like an acid trip, dissolving, you know, massive, you know, language environments, and then, you know, playing with them like musical parts.
He brought back the tactile qualities of language after it had been hypnotized for centuries into a visual reduction.
Mm-hmm.
Visual space, a logocentric reduction. He blew language. You know, it's like people say he prefigured the atomic bomb. He called it abnealization of the etym. Etym, E-T-Y-M, the beginning of etymology, studying the roots of language, the grammarian's enterprise. Mm-hmm. So he blew up the literate printed word into multi-levels and actually retrieved the original vibratory massage of the mother with the fetus through vibrations right through the skin, because they didn't even think they had skin.
Mm-hmm.
They thought it was one soul responding to the parent. So they vibrated and massaged and played the piano or the saxophone or electric guitar on the fetus.
Mm-hmm.
That's the tactile qualities of speech retrieved by Joyce.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's leave it at that. I got to go.
Okay. Thanks for hanging in there. I can hear your voice starting to go. So, it was good session.
Yeah. Okay. This is session 5, May 23rd, 2006. Dave Worster's 78th birthday today, May 23rd. Tomorrow will be Bob Dylan's birthday. He'll be 65. Okay. Here we go. We're on the second page of the book, which is called page 5. And the bottom quote, going over into page 7 in the McLuhan section, is, start reading.
Okay. Here is the prologue to the drama of Big Brother Watching You that later unfolds in The Tattler and the Spectator. Okay, so that's from VP, which is... Through the Vanishing Point. Okay. So that actually...
It's a quote juxtaposed up against a painting in the actual book, Through the Vanishing Point. And it's a painting by Peter Lely, Portrait of the Countess of Meath, which was probably... It's probably a painting from 1750 or 1700 approximately. I'm not sure. I'd have to go look at the book. You know, just the beginning of the 18th century. Because the Tattler... And the Spectator, they start in the 1700s, the London papers.
Oh, what is the Tattler and the Spectator? Is that a paper or a painting? Or
They're the first kind of journalistic newspapers in the Western world, at least in London, started by two guys, Addison and Steele.
Oh. Yeah, it sounds like a gossipy kind of paper. I mean, Tattler is not... You know, it doesn't sound like the New York Times. It sounds like, oh, we're going to do a little gossiping and speculation.
For literate people, it was for an elite, a literate elite in London society.
Mm-hmm.
Probably was gossip about aristocrats and ideas and things.
Right.
But it's just to read the quote again. Here is the prologue to the drama of Big Brother Watching You that later unfolds in The Tattler and the Spectator. And then in brackets... It has Latin, lo spettatore nel centro del quadro. And that's Through the Vanishing Point, page 109. And this probe by McLuhan and Harley Parker is collated with the Portrait of the Countess of Meath, which in that portrait, there's an aristocratic woman looking at you.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the gaze of Big Brother watching you. But McLuhan felt that women had more power than men in... I don't know if you would say in all societies, but in industrial societies, the women rule behind the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
He used to talk about the movie The Godfather. It should have been called The Godmother. Because the mother was the real control agent. I don't know if he would say that is true. I mean, the mafia is an oral society, so It's hard to tell. Big Brother watching you in the first beginnings of the industrial visual space coming in, creating that big government of the 19th century, that the irony is that it's a woman who's inaugurating it. Woman at Big Brother watching you.
Yeah.
So we're moving out of the oral feminine into the patriarchal visual government.
But the patriarchal visual government is still being powered by the woman behind the scenes.
Well, that's maybe depends on, I mean, definitely McLuhan said the left hemisphere favored patriarchal government because the left hemisphere failed. The visual space is better managed by the left hemisphere.
Right, so, but then as that becomes figure, well, you're displacing the feminine, so that what you suppress, you know, becomes powerful at the unconscious level.
Right, as the subplot, as the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So yes, the suppressed oral culture, what the postmodernists call the other, is the female.
Yeah.
So.
I think it's our emotional. It's our emotions that really power our, on many levels, power our decisions and our actions and our behaviors. Emotions are powerful and override the intellectual a lot. So, women are seen to be more emotional, or at least they were in the past, than men who are. And so, it's that emotive power behind the throne that's kind of actually, you know, pushing things forward.
Well, you're missing McLuhan's point. McLuhan points that emotion is cultural. So the intellect or the culture, the environment, which we wouldn't just limit to the intellectual, is the emotional quality.
Mm.
So you're thinking of the emotions as something different or separate or essential that are grounding us. But while we're in the McLuhan quadrant, his point is that emotions are cultural.
Mm-hmm.
Culturally biased, based on the ground that brings them in.
Yeah.
So it's a visual pun. Big Brother, as a woman, watching you in the painting, this aristocratic lady is she's the Countess of Meath, is just glaring at you, saying, watch out. Now, the next quote on the next page. Well, we don't need to go to that. I thought that continued the quote. It doesn't.
Yeah.
We've ended the quote. I'll just read it. This is McLuhan writing in the Gutenberg Galaxy, where he says, this externalization, this is on the next McLuhan page, page 7, actually. This externalization of our senses creates what Desjardins calls the noosphere, or a technological brain for the world. Instead of tending toward the vast Alexandrian library, the world has become a computer, an electronic brain, exactly as in an infantile piece of science fiction. And as our senses have gone outside, as Big Brother goes inside. Now, no, Big Brother goes back inside. That's the industrial control mechanism. The government agencies in the 19th century are forced to become what we call today the secret government. But they're going inside the newer government, which is the electronic media. So they operate behind the scenes, as almost on the margins. So
which government is prevailing here? The electronic government, which is their new matrix, or
right.
Their government inside the electronic government? I mean, they're both trying to manipulate each other.
Well, that's where you got to bring in the different bodies. The 19th century Big Brother is trying to control the chemical body. And the pollster guys, the Nielsen ratings, control the TV body.
Mm.
I mean, McLuhan did say the new Big Brother was the Nielsen ratings. But you still have that old environment that was made and is still operating in the ecology, and that's what we call Big Brother. So it only controls its territory. It doesn't control the TV body territory. So you have a juxtaposition there.
They're not interfacing, or are they not?
Well, they interface for Western cultures because it comes down to private identity.
Well, then would you say the TV body is not obstructing the directives of the secret government, which has its own...
agenda. No, it doesn't obstruct it. we could say that we didn't have nuclear war in the 60s and 70s because the generals couldn't harness the population in a monocrop kind of style to get everybody agree on that we need to nuke the Russia.
Right.
You know, there was no more homogeneity.
Right.
That was the service of the TV environment. It prevented the old Big Brother from carrying on what McClellan called the grand design.
Right.
So that was the breakthrough.
Of course, in your production of Who's Forgotten Furry Lent, you present a different scenario, according to Dr. Beter, about why that nuclear proliferation never happened. But
right. Well, that was within the Big Brother world.
Mm-hmm.
We stopped that. It did involve the radio broadcast of the Beter tape on that morning, September 17th, 1982.
Oh, that's right.
It was broadcast in Washington.
He feels that it blew the cover on the operation, and therefore it couldn't.
Yeah, it had to be done totally secretly, and so any word of it got out, and that created a problem.
Oh, yeah.
It's almost like Big Brother operates off the media, off the TV body, and as long as they operate there, the two will never meet, and they get to imagine they're accomplishing their purposes. And they may be accomplishing something. The TV shows every night show, you know, amazing dangers happening. Some guy's going to hijack the planet and blow it up or something, and then the mod squad comes in and stops them, right?
Yeah.
Save the day.
Yeah.
So that's why McLuhan thought Orwell's Big Brother, later on page 7, I have a quote where Orwell, he says in 1951, he said, "Trouble with duffers like George Orwell is that they satirize something that happened 50 years ago as a threat of the future." So, you know, McLuhan knew that the conventional images, and we see it in pop culture since the X-Files, that the shadow government is in control of everything, and that's a pretty naive view of what makes up government today. And government is the ecology of the four bodies. And then my radio shows, especially CKLN, I tried to tease that out.
Mm-hmm.
Mm. So that's why conspiracy can be marketed today as a big industry, because it's obsolete, that image, and therefore doesn't get at the accurate description of what's really going on, so it's commercial. It's saleable and a commodity.
Right.
But let's go back. So it's very important to understand that the Big Brother people think they are up against started in the 1700s with the newspaper.
Mm-hmm.
That's why it's the newspaper in my... LaRouche deals with Big Brother, and that's why I have newspaper in his quadrant.
Mm-hmm.
That's the beginning of a tribal collectivity that is the communication matrix for the industrial technologies, which goes way beyond the Gutenberg phase of, say, 1500 to 1700,
mm-hmm.
which is just strictly visual.
Mm-hmm.
So Big Brother is the beginning of kinetic manipulation of the population.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, you know, I was just thinking of it. I got maybe a little more insight into that. Gutenberg is still influences culture because, you know, LaRouche and these people still write books, and these books influence the thinking of the people who read them. But the thinking of the people who read them is pretty puny compared to the mass environment of the newspaper, which is affecting the thinking, everybody's thinking, who reads the newspaper, which is a much bigger audience than people who, you know, a few thousand people who read a book.
Right, that's why LaRouche put on a newspaper.
Oh, yeah.
I remember Mae Brussels saying when LaRouche was on Larry King in 1986, he said, "He's so different from his newspaper." She knew LaRouche from the newspaper, which was very excited headlines, right? Panicky headlines. She didn't read his books too much, so she didn't know the literary LaRouche. Mm. But she knew the headline LaRouche, the newspaper thing, and then said, "Wow, he's so different on TV." Well, LaRouche knew enough to be a little cooler on TV,
mm-hmm.
to be conversational, you know.
Mm-hmm.
He'd actually... undermined a lot of the headlines the way he talked on TV. He would, hum and ha and not appear such a hot character.
Mm-hmm.
He was more flexible.
Yeah.
In his opinions, he wasn't as precise. But in the newspaper, that's why, you know, we have him in the chart. I mean, he was miming the Tetra Manager. He had a different image in different media.
Yeah.
And he understood that.
Hmm. Well, it sounds like he understood McLuhan, it sounds like.
No, well, he understood the effect of different media four different audiences in a political context. He didn't understand McLuhan's point that the political context LaRouche was operating in had no ground anymore.
Yeah.
That's what he didn't know. It had a ground on the sidelines. So, you know, you have to look at this. When you said people are still reading books, every medium that's created maintains itself.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just like every function, species, or tree, organic outgrowth of first nature. It's part of an ecology.
Yeah.
You have to look at the newspaper world, in the addition to that, by the TV world and then the chip body, the three of them, plus the book world, the speech world, the ESP world or gestural world, they all still are here because they're organs like our bodies.
But during its heyday, each media or medium dominates. But when the newer mass media comes in, it shrinks. Its influence shrinks down and becomes less effective or possibly ineffective in relation to the newer, bigger, more mass media.
Right, but the McLuhan point is, it doesn't shrink down, it becomes what he calls elephantiasis, becomes as big as an elephant, it becomes obsolete, and obsolescence means it becomes pervasive. Like there is more, he used to say there's more handwriting than there ever was when that was a ground technology, the pen.
Mm-hmm.
There's more handwriting in the 20th century, but it has no effect to the electric environment. So it becomes puny because it absorbs our attention, and the ground is moved to the invisible, mm-hmm. to the inaudible. So when writing was an environment that was really affecting things, it wasn't seen. When it becomes seen, that means the actions move somewhere else. So we've had in the 20th century a lot of writing and opinionating, which what we call the information environment, and that was obsolete, therefore prevalent, compared to the ground, and the ground was a silent ESP, not an opinionating, expressive medium. The implosion of media in the mid-20th century is the silence that therefore makes noise, which is movies, music, opinionating, private and public expression in all these older media, is the figure. Therefore, it's actually shrunk in your terms, and the ground is way more powerful, and that ground is silence. If you think of ESP as a silent, what McLuhan called macroscopic gesticulation,
mm-hmm.
he uses that word a lot in War and Peace in the Global Village.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But silence will never be obsolete. Nobody notices the silence. Silence is hidden, and everybody notices the noise, and they participate and become absorbed and fascinated with
okay.
the content.
All right. This is an electronic silence. We now have, I say we've moved into the post-chip body, the post-communication matrix, which is a new kind of noise. And it's a Paleolithic warfare terrorism. It's invisible, it includes the silence, but the silence has become visible. So the silence of the electric media phase as ground now becomes figure. And that silence is the age of terror.
Well, do you mean that in this sense or in another sense? Do you mean that in the sense that we always knew who the enemy was and where they were located, and if we had satellites, we knew where their tanks and stuff were, but now the enemy is, I mean, we think we know who it is, we call it Al-Qaeda, but we don't know where they are operating or what they're thinking, or we can't develop a strategy because we don't know what their strategy is. They're operating in the invisible zone, and we can't point to them.
Right, and that is now figure. It always was that way in the 20th century. Big Brother was doing its protection of terrorism and fighting terrorism quietly, doing black jobs here and there, little rumors of it would surface in the newspapers, but no one could put their finger on it. So that most people thought didn't know that was happening. You know, Mae Bussell documented the secret murdering going on all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
So that was when terrorists were knowable and controllable.
Mm-hmm.
Half of them were funded by the government. So now that was in a Global Village surveillance matrix. Now we've moved out of that matrix. We don't know where anything is because we've lost our ability to track it.
Mm-hmm.
So an age of terror and paranoia everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
So the silence has become figure. So what's the ground of that? The ground of that is cold fusion and a breaking through into a whole new world, that a new context, a new technology that changes what the paranoia is about, changes the context of it. If paranoia is geared around preserving the wealth that the West has through oil technologies, then if we move beyond oil technology, that makes the whole battle over oil places, oil reservoirs, obsolete, right?
Mm-hmm.
So as long as we don't get to that cold fusion point, we're into the phase of silence is visible, and social policy is based on that.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, you tape everybody.
Right. Yeah. I mean, that has to be the...
But there is no definable reason, is there?
Yeah.
People say, well, what, I'm not saying anything wrong. Why invade my privacy? Well, when silence is available, when we move into the silent zone as figure, there's no way to judge anything, so we must tape everything.
Yeah. And if when the medium reaches its extreme, it flips into its opposite, well, taping everybody's phone call has got to be the extreme. You know,
right, they don't accomplish anything.
It's got to be the extreme before it's ready to flip into its opposite. But nevertheless...
No, it is the opposite form. It's communication for social protection carried to extreme. And nobody can do anything about it. So in that sense, the machine is taping itself.
Yeah, that's
where a meme is taping its own constituents.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, because that illuminates my intuition of the situation that I couldn't put into words, and that I haven't heard anybody put into words, you know.
Right.
Everybody's just worried about old privacy issues, like what you say don't exist anymore, but the deeper intuition is that the machine is just taping itself.
That's right. It's like Baudrillard's old joke in the 90s that the video player watches all the movies for you, because people would order tapes, bring in tapes, and never have time to play them. The reason they didn't have time is that the chip body in the 90s speeded up their life. So they had to engage with the chip body matter. So to take time to relax and go back in the TV body and watch a movie or watch a show you've taped, it never arrived. So it ended up in retrospect that the video player that you were using to tape all this data that you hoped one day to tape or to watch, the video player was enjoying it. So the Android meme was watching all the movies.
Yeah.
So that's in TV body terms. Now we have the chip body surveilling itself to the max.
Hmm. Now that is really a hard statement to swallow, but it's interesting for me to intuit what you're saying. The Android meme gets to enjoy watching the tapes. I mean, when you first thought that went through my mind when you said that was, okay, you're making an irrational analogy here. And then the next thought that went through my mind is, well, maybe the electronic environment has come alive and maybe it is enjoying itself doing this. But that's
well, maybe we don't have to say it's enjoying. It is doing the work.
Mm-hmm.
Which for people like to work because it distracts them or keeps them busy. It discharges their energy.
Yeah.
So the technology is working by and therefore enjoying itself,
right,
by doing the work of taping.
Yeah.
Processing the movie or show.
Right. Not that but you're not implying that it has any awareness of the content of the soap opera that's being taped. It doesn't pay attention to that. It just pays attention to the fact that the electronic environment is processing data, and that's what it does.
You're projecting a chemical body idea of awareness. Look at how the Android meme's constituents communicate among themselves. Every night, the Nielsen's or whatever ratings they use decide who watched what And then advertising goes toward that show. It's all about getting the advertising dollars.
Yeah.
Okay, so the real...
But that's just sensible economics.
Well, what is economics? It's just tool to use to survive.
No, it's people trying to keep their businesses running so that people can pay their rent and buy the latest fashions. And the way they do that is that they produce a product or a service, and they have to get it out there and sell it. And that's where the advertising dollars go.
You're putting into the 19th century LaRouche quadrant the idea of economics and missing the point that people don't. You're forgetting what we learned last week about myth. Myth is participation. People watch television to participate, not for economic reasons. Advertising is the linchpin back to the old 19th century economic structure of I give you something and you give me something in exchange. With information, nobody gains in the exchange, nobody loses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So advertising pays for supposedly all the stuff you do. If we had a economic crash and we didn't have any money, nothing. I don't know how people would survive on the food level, but whatever means they had the food, they'd still be listening to the media.
Yeah.
And they'd starve to death, maybe, because that's their TV body, a necessary part of their organs that must be fed.
Right.
So let's not just look at it for economic reasons. So all that you said 3 minutes ago about economics, that's just minor chemical body reasons. Advertising is the means to organize what data gets on the show the next day.
Mm-hmm.
It's the lifeblood.
Yeah.
It's the coherency. If we didn't have advertising, since we're bureaucratic by nature, by previous media culture, we need to sift out what's going to be organized, the wealth and distribution of attention is going to go here or there based on the ratings. So the ratings are the things that judge the results.
Right. Well, I hear what you're saying, but I guess I'm belaboring the point, but I just don't see. I mean, if advertising didn't sell products and services, nobody would pay for it. So you do have to tie it back to that fundamental principle.
But you know, no, advertising defines its role traditionally as the fluid to keep the economy going, because people need to be made abreast of the new wonderful products that are coming. So where McLuhan says advertising advertises advertising, you have to take whatever noun you're focusing on, products, money, economy, and see that it merges like a page of Finnegan's Wake across the whole media spectrum. So you cannot say where advertising begins and advertising stops, because movies are just ads enlarged.
Mm-hmm.
3 minute, a 30-minute ad made into an hour and a half.
Yeah, but there's that aspect of product placement where Coca-Cola pays to have somebody drink a Coke in the middle of a movie.
That's my point.
That's still selling a hard service or product, which is what people produce in order to earn a living. You have to factor that in. You can't pretend it's that media advertising, and which runs the information content and in the media is detached from working people, products and services, and livelihoods.
I'm not saying that. The working economy, which is supposedly shrinking, right, where are the jobs going? But for the chemical body, that working industrial, money-exchanging, surviving environment is part of the ecology. But if you stay focused on that one quarter and think that's all there is, you're missing a lot of factors, like the other bodies and their environments and landscapes and how they make up an ecology. You're missing it. So that's why McLuhan says advertising advertises advertising. Participating in today's culture and having a job is a form of advertising in relation to other cultures.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to expand and show that every, as Joyce used in Finnegan's Wake, every word evoked every other word in every other language. Then in this modern, our present situation, every medium that we've built evokes every other medium. Therefore, you get the seamless web.
Mm-hmm.
That's the fact from the 60s on, under satellite conditions first and then the digital. So to look at the workers, you need customers, you need people in other parts of the world to make the resources that to make you, to be brought to your factories to make the products, and then your products are sent back out to them. Now it's all backwards. China makes all the products, and we're the consumers. So we're not making anything, as Frank Zappa complained once in that interview Bob Marshall did with him. But we're not making anything industrially, but we're making the information matrix that wears the shoes that China sends to us.
Mm-hmm.
See, so the idea here is to break down all the boundaries. China is a bigger component of the American economy than Americans are. They are more American in the industrial sense than we are. So when you say the word advertising, don't limit yourself to the image you normally define advertising with.
Yeah, I can do that, yeah.
In other words, when I'm watching a sports game, I'm engaging in advertising.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And then what do we call when the ad comes on? The ad comes on at certain points in the game. That's the news of new games coming or of something totally unrelated, of new wars coming. Let's integrate. This is the complex awareness of media yoga. You must get rid of the terminology, see how they go across the board and melt, and therefore what you're doing is a metaphor for the old models that come from science fiction. You're on Mars, or a snake has taken over the planet. Any of those old science fiction models are crotchety approximations of the actual situation and more accurate than any non-science fiction realistic presentation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So let's go back to that phrase. Advertising advertises advertising. It's like Gertrude Stein, a rose is a rose is a rose. But see, that's a noun, is. It doesn't get into the process like saying advertising advertises advertising.
Right.
So Big Brother and all the images you have of that controlling you is an image you got to get rid of to understand how Big Brother is within an ecology, forcing people to work, not giving them a free economy. As you say, everybody has to do it. We're not ignoring it. We're showing how the image we have of that activity is a minor part of the ecology. The ecology is made up of other environments. Doesn't get rid of it. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So that's where, in some ways, people think neoconservatism means it was presented in the late 70s, early 80s, as let's get back to common sense, let's get practical, not get carried away by media sensationalism. Let's get back to the hardworking values. It was a futile attempt to move it back into the 19th century, but it isn't going to work. But what was interesting is that the image of that effort matched with the American archetype and therefore was the content of wealth making, preserving that image from the Reagan on presidency.
Mm-hmm.
Think of the macro myth, media's macro myth. So, as Americans went through this preservation of the American legacy in the 80s and 90s under the Reagan and post-Reagan era, what was the result? More Japanese vehicles, more German purchasing of the major media, and more jobs leaving the landscape known as the United States of America. It was only an image that was preserved.
Mm-hmm.
Because that image was a minor landscape compared to the chip body landscape that was growing and absorbing and assimilating millions of people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that chip body has no particular location.
Yeah, to extend this idea of no location a little bit further in relating back to China producing our goods and services, my friend Karen's reading a book right now. It's about the new level of corporate takeover that's going on, where they're suggesting that they're looking at actually building barges in order to have floating factories that can move around from one country to another in order to take advantage of the cheapest labor.
Right.
So the factory itself doesn't even is mobile.
Right. They take advantage, I guess, of offshore.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, they're thinking about building a platform 3 miles offshore because then I forget how many miles offshore, and then putting a bunch of computer programmers out there because they can still be close enough to America so that they don't have the language and the distance problems, but they can be outside the taxable. Taxable and pay scale and
cultural standards.
Yeah, cultural standards and
of the old humanist vision.
Yeah.
And, you know what that reminds me of? That's partly some of Bucky Fuller's ideas in the 1560s. You know, could have cities floating around the planet. He really wanted to get everybody into the ocean because he was a sailor. But Bucky's vision is now manifesting under the dark side, under an exploitative sense, not the liberatory sense that he thought this ocean mobility would bring in.
Yeah.
And that chip body, you see, Bucky's a TVH guy, TV body, but the chip body totally reversed the context for his visions.
Yeah, well, this darker manifestation of Bucky's vision seems to me to be still the influence of this oligarch, this hidden big brother, these greedy individuals.
It's the money medium.
Yeah.
It's the alphabetic and print medium where you're Scott and I'm Bob.
Yeah.
Matter of fact, a good book to read is a book called The Chairman, which is about